Hello and a very warm welcome indeed to Quadriga. And this week, as German Chancellor Angela Merkel visits China, we take a closer look at Beijing's geopolitical ambitions. President Xi Jinping has established himself as China's leader for life, and he seems determined to transform his country into the dominant global power. It's already challenging the US as the world's biggest economy, and now China is extending its strategic and commercial influence through the creation of a giant trading network known as the New Silk Road. So our question on Quadriga this week is, the New Silk Road, China's route to Europe? And to discuss that question, I'm joined by three excellent analysts here in the studio, beginning with Bernhard Bartsch, who's a senior expert on China for the Bertelsmann Foundation. He believes that time to balance China's influence in a reasonable way may be running out. Also with us is Andreas Kluth, editor-in-chief of Handelsblatt Global. He was once based in Hong Kong and has for many years followed the rise of China. Andreas says that Europe should stop being naive. China has a plan for economic domination of the Eurasian landmass and seas. And a very warm welcome too to Ruth Kirschner. Ruth is a freelance journalist and China expert, and she argues that China's Belt and Road Initiative is a good idea in principle, but she goes on, it lacks transparency and ties participating countries into an authoritarian system. Thank you all three for being here with me today. I'd like to begin with you, Andreas, with that big statement at the top of the show. You say China has a plan for the economic domination of the Eurasian landmass and seas. So how close is Beijing to realizing that goal?
Beijing has a long time horizon, which is one of the things that distinguishes China from the Western democracies. And it also looks far back. And in the Chinese narrative, China once was the economic superpower of the world. In our Middle Ages, the Tang Dynasty and onwards, and then came the great humiliation at the hands of the West, when the Western countries, through the Industrial Revolution, passed it by and left it behind.
Very important for the Chinese psyche.
Yes, and they dwell on it today, to an extent that is surprising to us there, the Opium Wars and whatnot. But in their narrative, it's now all about re-establishing what is rightfully theirs, which is economic power alongside other powers, and I think economic dominance eventually, and to translate that economic power into political power. And for that, they have, unlike the West, a coherent plan that has elements like the New Silk Road, like the targeted theft and transfer of technology and more.
Mm-hmm. Ruth Kirschner, are we already living in the Chinese century?
No, I don't think we're already living in the Chinese century. What I think what's happening, what we're witnessing, is a shift of power centers and away from the U.S. But I don't think this is China centered yet. But China is going to play a much more dominant role in the future.
A more expansive role?
A more expansive role, definitely economically, and we see that through grand schemes like the One Belt One Road Initiative or the Belt and Road Initiative, as it's now called in China. But where China wants to move politically and strategically, I think that is still a much more open question. We're not quite sure yet.
Mm-hmm. And Bernhard Bartsch, you say time to balance China's influence in a reasonable way. In a reasonable way, could be running out. What does that mean?
If you look at what's happening in the US, where scapegoating China for taking America's job away has become a dominant political theme, then that is quite a dangerous populist path to take. In Europe, we can be quite happy that we're not there yet. But of course, China poses a lot of challenges to the global trading system, to global governance, and there have to be a lot of negotiations for what the global world order is going to be. Mm-hmm. And until we can still discuss reasonably and we don't have populist movements and we don't have politicians who campaign on scapegoating China for our problems, there is still a chance for good diplomacy to work things out.
And when you talk about scapegoating China, you guys at the Bertelsmann Foundation, you've come up with a new report looking at China buying up high-tech, high-end companies around Europe in Germany. That is viewed as a threat by many people in Germany because they believe that the Chinese, it's the cliche, isn't it? They believe that the Chinese are going to copy, reproduce and leave the Europeans lying in the dust. Or is it more complicated than that?
It is more complicated than that because China is now openly saying that they want to become world leaders in core technologies in the next couple of years. And what our report shows is that they're very strategically buying German and other European Western technology companies. Mm-hmm. And the problem there is that our markets are very open. They're basically welcome to come and invest here, while their markets are closed and closing even more. So the problem is a level playing field.
And this buy-up that you've been identifying and writing about, it takes place with state backing. So it makes for an unfair playing field, as it were.
Absolutely. We don't know the ownership structures. There's state money in there. It's tied to this big plan, Made in China 2025. We are all for competition. That's what the German economic model is built on. But China is very much unleveling the playing field. And that kind of manipulation is a big problem for the German industry.
Andreas.
Yeah, if you just want to spell out that point about the unlevel playing field, the way in recent weeks what the Chinese have been doing is they've built a surreptitious shareholding in Daimler. A Chinese company has bought up without acknowledging it at the proper time. A stake of about 10% in Daimler. So that's one of the technologies they're after. Right now, they're having a second attempt to buy into an electricity grid operator that is also quite strategic. And people, and I think I liked what you said about in America, it's gone too far. The populists, Trump, have taken the debate. Here, for some reason, that hasn't entered the populist sort of bullhorn yet. But there are, I believe in Germany, for instance, most people are unaware of this, but people like Peter Altmaier, the new economics minister, it's now his job to think calmly but firmly about this. And because, for instance, the thing on his desk is right now the Chinese are trying to buy into the electricity grid operator again, and by our rules. He could, I think, intervene once they get 25%, I believe, and they stop just short of that at 20%, and he has a few weeks to decide. He doesn't want them to have it. What does he do? So that's the dilemma we're in. We have rules and laws, and we can't change those quickly, and they, because they have state backing, they do whatever they want.
Okay, at the heart of our discussion today is the New Silk Road Project. It's a massive transport and trading initiative that traces the ancient trading routes of the Old Silk Road. There are two main routes. One is the land route from China and across Central Asia, the Middle East and Russia into Eastern Europe before reaching the German city of Duisburg. There's also a maritime route that links southern China and Southeast Asia with East Africa before then also leading to Europe. Let's find out a little bit more now about what may well be the largest infrastructure project in history.
Chinese President Xi was joined by representatives from more than 100 countries last year at the Silk Road Summit in Beijing. Among the participants, Turkish President Erdogan and Russian President Putin. Not in attendance, German Chancellor Merkel. The new Silk Road project intends to do much more than revive the old trade routes. With an investment of $900 billion, China wants to build an almost global trade network with roads, railways, ports and airports. It would connect China with Central Asia, Africa and Europe. It's about business, but also about establishing influence and political power. In Germany and most other European countries, there's still a feeling of mistrust. EU officials won't currently sign a joint declaration. They say Xi doesn't adhere to European values of transparency or environmental and social standards. China is advancing west, but who'll be using the new Silk Road?
Ruth Kirshner, who will be using the new Silk Road, and is it a threat or an opportunity?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, really. It's an opportunity for a lot of countries that desperately need infrastructure investment, both in Asia, in Central Asia, but also in some parts of Europe and, of course, in Africa.
That all sounds very benign.
That is, the idea as such, I think, is benign, and as I think is perfectly understandable to actually improve transport links and connectivity across those regions. I think what we need to look at very carefully is individual projects and who is benefiting, who is financing these projects, who are the companies or where are the companies from, mainly from China, who are building these projects, and where does it leave the countries that are involved in these projects? Does it leave them with higher debt levels, as we've seen in some countries? Are these projects really beneficial to the countries that sign up to it?
It almost does China have a neo-colonial agenda? It almost sounds at times like the British building trains in India.
They would definitely say that they're not colonial, but when we look at it, it definitely is a geopolitical project. It's not only about trading and building infrastructure. The second step is, of course, building political influence and basically reshaping the world order around the countries that join the new Silk Road.
So you feel that it was right and good for Angela Merkel not to have attended the Silk Road summit?
Yes, the challenge here is that we have to take up China's offer to say that this is a multilateral project, because this would be a good idea. In theory, it's a good thing. But in practice, until now, it is not. And the challenge here is to work with China, because we need China as a partner. We're not going to contain China in any way. We shouldn't. And at the same time, we have to acknowledge that China has a very strong strategy there where we have none, that we don't have similar offers that we can make to emerging economies, telling them we can help you to build power stations and networks, train networks, in a similar way. So we have to be more receptive to their needs and come up with an alternative. And only if we have an alternative, and it's actually in the German coalition treaty that we need a European alternative to the Silk Road, only then can we put pressure on China to level the playing field and make it a truly multilateral.
And I think part of the problem is that a lot of these projects can be both. They have a strategic aim, but they also have economic benefits. So if you build a harbour for a country, I mean, that's good for trade, but you could actually also use it for other purposes, military, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I think part of that is that we're never quite sure what we're talking about. And, of course, on the Chinese side, it's also the lack of transparency.
Mm-hmm. It's also, Andreas, this is surely about values. We used to naively in the West assume that if there's trade and there's commerce and there are markets, the byproduct would be democracy. That has now proved to be rather naive, to put it mildly.
Absolutely. And that whole mixture of economics and politics, I don't think the Chinese see that distinction. That is a Western liberal idea. And I think a mercantilist and economic nationalist doesn't have that idea. And I just want to say that in the same places where they're building the road and as well as the belt, for instance, that of course overlaps with, for instance, the South China Sea, where they're deliberately also trying to get America in. They have a strategy of extending that perimeter where into which they can project Chinese power and prevent American power from being projected. And then the South China Sea, they're simultaneously turning small islets into permanent aircraft carriers. And they're happily picking off the Philippines and other countries that were in the American or the Western orbit. And that's difficult for countries like New Zealand and Australia in the long term, and bringing them into their orbit. So they see this as one project. And that's why I call it coherent. And that is something that we were not used to having.
Bernhard, I'd just like to shift the focus a little bit, because we're talking about two things here. We're talking about China's strategy, but we're also talking about Angela Merkel's visit to Beijing, which is currently taking place. It's her 11th visit to Beijing in 12 years in office. Yeah, that's very diligent. Yeah, that's very committed. How is she seen in China? Is she an important voice?
I think at the moment, China is quite willing to listen to Germany and Europe, because they need Europe, or they hope that Europe could play a role to balance the US. And then there are very long-standing personal connections. At the same time, China is very realistic about what they can do with European countries. And yes, they need Angela Merkel as the leader of the strongest European country. At the same time, they're doing a lot to drive European countries apart.
I'd be interested for your take on that, Ruth, because I discovered a quote from Angela Merkel saying that China really only views Europe as a sort of peripheral Asian peninsula. Is it that bad?
No, I don't think it's that bad, but I think the Chancellor is very realistic about the role Germany can or cannot play. Mm-hmm. And Germany is the biggest economy in Europe, is the most important country within the EU, but from the Chinese perspective, it's still a relatively small country. Mm-hmm. And so I think the Chancellor is realistic about how much weight she actually has. She knows about... there's, of course, Germany's economic power, but when it comes to the big geopolitical questions, Germany's voice counts a lot less, and I think that has to be taken into account.
But we're suddenly discovering, aren't we, that because we talked about differences between Europe and China, there's suddenly a lot of common ground.
There is a lot of common ground, and there isn't, because when it comes to trade, both countries, neither China nor Germany or the EU, want tariffs slapped on some of their exporting goods. Also, Germany and the US have common interests vis-à-vis China when it comes to market access and when it comes to economic policies in China and what those both countries want to see change. So I think that puts actually Chancellor Merkel in a pretty difficult position. Mm-hmm. She wants, on the one hand, to keep communication channels with the US open, and yep. and Germany needs the US. I mean, China and the US are Germany's biggest trading partners. But she also wants to carry on with the very good relations with China, but doesn't want to be seen to be that she's sort of being pushed into sort of China's arms because of the conflicts with the Americans.
You're nodding.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's right. I have two fears about this, and one is, first of all, I do think it's as bad as that quote suggests. From the Chinese point of view, Europe is a little appendage, a peninsula at the end of Asia. And I think that Europe could become, in this century, which is still young, rule takers, not rule makers. Mm-hmm. And the second fear is that the Chinese might clash with the reigning or waning superpower, which is America. And I was really intrigued when I was there, this is now years ago, when I was speaking to young scholars inside the Chinese Communist Party, and what they wanted to talk about is the historical clash between Britain and Germany in the 19th century, because that was the British century, and Germany rose to build its empire, its place in the sun, and it led to eventually World War I, which they wanted to avoid, the Chinese. And I'd be interested if they still are as keen to avoid that permanently, or if they just want to avoid it until such a time as when they think they could win such a showdown with the US. So I think it's actually a dangerous world, and I think, again, the 19th century was British, the 20th was American. This one, which is just starting, will be Chinese.
OK, very interesting thoughts indeed, Andreas. Let's just go back a little bit to the New Silk Road. And as we have seen, the Western German city of Duisburg is an important hub on the route. But what does that mean in concrete terms for this once prosperous city that has more recently hit on harder times?
Duisburg, after 11,000 kilometres, one trade route of the New Silk Road ends here. 25 trains a week arrive with goods and hope for the future. Chinese investors are very welcome here. We will be building a China trade centre here. On this land behind us, we will have 120,000 square meters of office space over five stories. That's appealing to a region with high unemployment. The coal industry lost tens of thousands of jobs last year. Duisburg is also one of Europe's largest inland ports, an ideal hub to forward goods on. But how reliable is China as an investor?
Bernard Bartsch, that's a good question. How reliable is China as an investor? It could be engaging in massive overstretch here.
Well, if we look at it from a German perspective, then they're not very big investors yet. They're strategic investors. If you look at the Silk Road, they have a lot of money to spend there, but they can't buy the world. They will need other countries to support the initiative. And I think that's the main challenge there. It's not only about money. Mm-hmm. And actually, we should not only look at the money that China spends. We are also spending a lot of money. The West is spending a lot of money. It's not like China invented building bridges and roads in developing countries. Maybe they invented that 5,000 years ago, but right now they're doing what the World Bank and a lot of other developing agencies have been doing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because China, in advance of Merkel's visit to Beijing, has been complaining itself and asking how reliable is Germany as a trading partner. China points to, and I'm quoting here, a protectionist trend in Germany, saying only 0.3% of foreign investors in Germany stem from China, while German firms have invested 80 billion euros in China in recent decades. The charge is economic exchange cannot be a one-way street.
That
Andreas,
yeah,
I mean, it's outrageous. This is the cynicism in that.
This has been the Chinese ambassador to Germany speaking out, much quoted in advance of Angela Merkel's visit.
Yes, and they've got quite good at sort of rhetorical red herrings, and at, you know, you shape the debate in advance. He was posing at Davos as the Xi Jinping as protector of free trade. Suddenly, this is very cynical. Those billions of German investment and the many other billions of American and British and other investment in China, we could talk about that. What happens to that? There are strict rules that they have to form joint ventures with local partners. There are stories from German Mittelstand companies of having these joint ventures, of having factories. The employees looked really tired, so one day the German boss drives home to see where they're going, and they're going to an identical factory at night, working a second shift, recreating what they learned during the day. So these billions of they have used this investment into China to, I would say, steal and transfer and copy and then improve on key technologies. And so there is so much wrong with that sort of allegation. I don't even know where to start. And I think we shouldn't fall for it.
Yeah, and if you look at the openness of both markets, the European market and the Chinese market, I mean, it's very clear that the EU market is very, very open to foreign investment, and a lot of the investments that are happening here would not be possible vice versa, because the Chinese are protecting their own industries and don't have the same openness in their investment rules and regulations as the Europeans. So I think those quotes by the Chinese ambassador, I mean, they were designed to sort of steer the debate in a certain direction. I would agree with Andreas, but it's very hard to take that seriously.
And how much divide and rule is there in the Chinese strategy? We're certainly seeing an element of that. A Chinese attempt, it would seem, to drive a wedge between Eastern European countries and Western European countries and Brussels.
I think there is a certain amount of sort of divide and rule, but a part of it is that the Europeans allow this or let this happen. There are very different interests in different parts of Europe. There are some countries that definitely want Chinese investment in their infrastructure. There are other countries like Germany that do welcome Chinese investment of all sorts, but have become a bit more wary of it recently and are now much keener on maybe screening Chinese investments a bit more carefully. So I think the challenge here for the Europeans is to come up with a sort of joint strategy, as always. And so come up with a joint strategy how to go about this challenge.
Bernhard, a quick word
to make it specific, one of the big discussions we're having at the moment is how are we going to monitor and control investment in Europe? And that is something that, by European law, we have to decide in Brussels. And the issue there is that China is very strongly represented, especially in Eastern European countries. So China is, in fact, sitting at the table and has its allies who are going to sabotage some of these initiatives.
Are you going to name some names there for us?
Well, Hungary is the country that is very much discussed at the moment. Mm-hmm. There was, coming back to the Silk Road, the famous, I should actually say, report by European ambassadors in Beijing, who made a report about how this new Silk Road is a very China-dominated and very manipulative initiative. And the Hungarian ambassador was the only one who didn't sign that report and didn't share in the concern of his colleagues.
Interesting. OK, we're running out of time. I'd just like to get an answer to our core question today. Andreas, is China coming to Europe, in a word?
Yes, of course. They're already here. It's going to be a Chinese century. We have to get used to it.
Is China coming to Europe?
They're already here, and they're here to stay, and so we have to think carefully how to deal with them.
Bernhard?
They're here. It's good that they're here. They're welcome that they're here. We can't out-Chinese the Chinese, but we want to be there too, and we want a world with a level playing field.
Thanks very much for that and all your thoughts today. Thank you to all three of you for being here on Quadriga. Our topic has been the New Silk Road, China's routes to Europe. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye and tschüss.